Okay, so when the audiences flip into users through participation, they flip from being formal calls to being efficient calls?
Yeah, and that's the numbness. When you get into efficient calls, you're addicted to the environment. You keep using it and ignoring the cause, the effects on others, which includes other media, the effects on other media and others in other countries. You're too busy ignoring the formal causality.
Yeah, and if we follow it all the way through, then insofar as the audiences are doing it for themselves, or the audiences flipping into users and doing it for themselves as audience, then they also become final cause?
No, I don't know. What is final cause?
Well, I guess at the end of the day, I guess it's God, or whatever word you want to use in that place.
But if you take house, final cause, it comes from efficient cause. You use the house to do your normal habitual stuff in the house. So the efficient cause of making the house then becomes the yeet of the house, and that's final cause. It's the later stage of efficient use of it. Then again, you have this analysis of nouns, you know, the making of the house, the speaking of a sentence, and then the final meaning. That's about books and about particular objects, not environments. See, that's a problem with Wilhelmsen. He's looking at objects that are made, not the environment of houses.
Yep.
And so I think McLuhan says users of environment, efficient cause, and then juxtaposes that former causality, which is indicated by Ovid's Tales. That's an attempt to show the metamorphoses that the users go through. And look, he uses the vortices of cultures. There he is, updating the vortices tradition. He doesn't use the word vortices too much.
No.
So tales of the vortices. The vortices would be the Manipians or the studies of formal causality. Tales of the vortices of cultures, past and present. So the title of the book is...
What is this book even about? I haven't read this book. In Tales of the Tar Sands. Have you read this book, Bob?
I never heard of it, and it's pretty inconsequential. I think it's a local author. It was... Are you laughing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, here's the point. It was given to Marshall by another guy, George Hendry. George Hendry's not someone I knew, but he's just some guy who thought McLuhan should use the book or find it useful. So Tales of the Tar Sands about Alberta or something, isn't it?
I'm just Googling it right now.
Oh, the book itself?
Yeah, it looks like an environmental tract of some description.
Okay, let me check your work. I will do my own reading of it. Tales of the Tar Sands, Our Roots, cover page. Not much of contents, okay.
Wonderful. Same place as I am, yep.
Yeah, the Great Waterway Railway, the Northern News, Bush Pilots, Old Joe Whittle, they look like tales, like fiction. The Staff of Life. Now, where can I get a better view of it? The wonderful light of...
I think we might have to agree with you here, Bob, that it possibly is inconsequential. It's quite odd that you actually call everything anything inconsequential.
Yeah, no, it's typical the kind of crap that people who had no clue what McLuhan was about, they read some book and they thought, oh, Marshall reads books, he'd like this book that my sister wrote. You know, this kind of stuff. I'm just trying to see the tar sands, that is a whole, isn't that where they developed the oil or something? Canadian tar sands. Yeah, look, a reliable resource to meet U.S. energy demands. The bituminous sands, colloquially known as oil sands or tar sands, are a type of unconventional petroleum deposit. And I think there's a lot of them up in Alberta. Okay, so yeah, the development. So Tales of the Tar Sands is probably just stories about people in that part of the world, northern Alberta. So it's nothing. And so let's say that this is Marshall's comment on the idiot guy who gave him this stupid book, okay? He says, this guy Hendry
He thinks I'd be interested in these books, which are just about users of the environment of the tar sands who are stuck in a fishing cause. And then he might say, well, wait a minute. Maybe these are tales of the vortices of cultures past and present. These could be comments on after having read the book. Or there just may be comments of what he's thinking at the time, and this is the note paper available.
Yeah, which is
sort of like the toilet paper.
Yep.
Okay, so interesting comment from James J. Lewis. Well, we know him. He goes, most excellent blog. Please keep up the superb work. Yeah, well, it's pretty tiny what Andrew is doing at this point. Here's the thing is, though, I mean, I guess this note is interesting. If one knows, I don't know how much of Andrew knows of Marcel's work, he might know enough to know that this is an odd statement. Users of environment equals efficient cause. And it actually fits the Fritz Wilhelmsen letter that you got. That's where it fits, you know. Don't know if Andrew meant that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful accident if it didn't, that it actually, it seems to present McLuhan responding, or at least attempting to respond to Wilhelmsen's splitting of hairs.
Yeah, and here's his Maritain exists. Nothing about Wilhelmsen. It's Mark Stallman's remark that draws our attention to Wilhelmsen, which is great because then that leads to that letter, which brings in the whole argument of efficient cause. I mean, this is Bob serendipity. This works for me all the time, Andrew.
We just got to follow our nose, Bob. You know.
Yeah, we just follow what we want to do. You want to read that letter? It's going to relate to the next entry 2 months down the way. No problem. It'll fit. I mean, that's incredible. We work from Mark Stallman's suggestion, look up the letters, and then we find out this particular argument over efficient cost to the point we might even say McLuhan is considering Wilhelmsen's definitions here.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, he might have looked at this book the day he wrote that letter, or that he got that letter and reviewed it. I like the fact that McLuhan has a lot of question marks, like, what's he mean with that? What's that mean? What is this? McLuhan carrying on a dialogue. He doesn't understand what he's saying. McLuhan's a manipulative satire on himself. You know, that whole thing that Wilhelmsen talks about, what Ion calls the distance between you and you, that is what's talked about there by Wilhelmsen. You know, you're talking to yourself, right?
He talks about this being the infinite regress that
Right, and to use the infinite regress, that's if he knew McLuhan enough, he'd know that's the Aunt Jemima cover that McLuhan refers to all the time. That's a product of the printing press, the infinite regress. So when Wilhelmsen uses that word, he has to indicate to McLuhan that he's aware of how McLuhan means it, but he doesn't. And so we don't know if Wilhelmsen is duped by infinite regress. They don't know enough about McLuhan to. That's why McLuhan. He said, "What the hell am I reading? I'm talking to this guy. He knows nothing about my work." How he got a job running any department in the university is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, but he gets him around it. He sets him on a project, and he puts him on that world communication project, and he gives him the task, and he says, this is how you're going to do it. You're an incredible philosopher and professor and everything, but here's the simple guidelines, and off you go.
Yeah, it's like McLuhan, he makes a communication to the public. Where were we reading this? Dave Worster, when Avaton took the mailing list and advertised the Cosmic Awareness booklet, Dave said it took him 6 months to to weed through the nuts that came. You understand the relevance of this?
Yeah.
Dave Worster complained that when Avaton took the Pauline route and spread the word about what Dave had been talking about and what Doobie had been channeling, they took 6 weeks. 6 months and weed through all the nuts that respond.
So McLuhan takes the Pauline method, writes a book. He gets nothing but not showing up. The best he can do is give them jobs. The best he can do is give them assignments. I remember he gave me an assignment. He told me to go to England, look up the relatives of the people who lived in Stratford, who in the oral tradition had stories from their grandparents and great grandparents going back to the time of Shakespeare. And we can find out what the neighbors thought of Shakespeare. We know what their end, their descendants.
They would have kept you busy, Bob?
Yes. This Bob Dog's another nut that I've drawn in because I made the mistake of being published. I should have followed Jesus and Socrates' rule and don't write anything down. And, you know, there are a lot of nuts that we know about that are around McLuhanism.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
We're probably on the list of the worst of them.
But we know it. We understand the effects of what McLuhan did. The other nuts are claiming they're not nuts. Okay, so anyways, I think we made a good discovery there. This whole thing that, McLuhan gave assignments to the nuts that he attracted, and there were many nuts that came around the coach house. Mark Stewart told me stories of these people, and Marshall was pretty skillful in handling them.
Well, when I was there, when we were there, actually, in 04, I had to deal with a couple of them. They were still coming.
Yeah, that's right.
I had 2 hours with a guy who was telling me how effectively McLuhan gave him an assignment, and so he went off down to South America and found what he believed was a residue of the oral tradition, and he discovered secret knowledge. And he propaganded me for 2 hours. He was going to try and punch me out just because he had the secret. He cracked the code of his assignment.
Yeah, so McLuhan sends him on an assignment. He actually discovers way more than what McLuhan knew, right? He actually comes back upbraid or bring McLuhan into line because the new knowledge is more important than McLuhan. Something like that?
Yes, pretty much.
And the guy wasn't a fellow.
No, this was some guy that was around the McLuhan scene in the, late 60s, early 70s, and, it's like he'd been on assignment for 20 years or something.
Well, why was he there at this, late date? There wasn't even a coach host, really. Why was he there?
Because that's where he got his assignment from.
Oh, no, but he came back. He had just returned?
More or less.
And McLuhan had been dead for 25 years. Yeah. Tales of the Tar Sands. We should look up George Henry. Find out who he is. Interview him. See if he can remember the day that he... he probably didn't even give the book. McLuhan wrote the wrong name down. Okay, so shall we move on? I mean, lots of food for thought there. Much.
Indeed. H dwells beneath the shadow of the Iron Age.
Yeah, but it's just that Barry Nevitt used to, they go, oh, this is rich. McLuhan would say, someone could do a PhD thesis on this entry. This is rich.
Right, okay. For a revolution, Bob. It's right for a revolution. I hope there's some space for you. What does he say to Colkin? That's, I hope there's, where is the often used line? 1 second. I've missed it.
Okay, there's something McLuhan said to Colkin?
Yep, this matter of formal causality and the environments created by media is so big that I hope your new academic setup will be able to take a hold of some of it. And so he's go off and grab it.
I know, he actually formed a center for culture and technology down there in the state somewhere after he left the priesthood. He actually used the same McLuhan name almost.
Yeah, it was down in New York City, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe Chicago, but let's say New York, because that was his base, New York. But I think he had to move on, go somewhere else. But the what can I say? Yes, there's a level. Sometimes I think, if anybody is like McLuhan, it's me. If you want to know what McLuhan was like, you watch how I operate. Right?
Well, in talk, yes. It would be interesting if somebody gave you a coach house and a small budget, Bob. It would be...
I am all kind, but I'm already doing it. I already got people doing stuff. They make albums. They make YouTubes. They produce voluminous stuff. They even started appreciating each other's work. All spin-offs from my endless talking on the telephone.
Yeah, we all know the fate of the one-eyed man in the... what is it? In the Kingdom of the Blind?
Yeah, Hand Signals for the Blind. That's what my play is all about. Hand Signals for the Blind when one of you is a king. Has one eye open. Now, okay, but no, there's something very pranksterish going on here. McLuhan is an urban terrorist. Definitely an urban terrorist. This is what Sue Bone accused me and Carolyn of when she got to know us in the 70s. You guys are urban terrorists. You know, you have very respectful patina. You got it all covered, you know. McLuhan going to mass every day, but... the point is he's so ridiculous. Like, he doesn't even know he's using the words wrong. It doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Yet there's gems in that.
Yeah. He got it. It's almost like he didn't really talk. He'd rather be in the silence. If he was going to talk, he was going to make sure it really messed things up. If you're going to make me talk, if you're going to make me use words, then I'm going to really destroy them. Oh, yeah, I didn't get to finish the time and space thing. When I laid out the different uses of time and space, then McLuhan purposely reversed the meaning. I didn't get to that point. He uses time and space in the opposite sense of the way Joyce uses it and Innes uses it. He purposely takes what is given in a dialectic and then changes the meaning. You ever notice that?
Specifically with hot and cold, can you point to something more concrete we can look at?
Okay, let's do time and space. Time is emotion and the druidic. That's the oral culture. Space is visual. But McLuhan really means time is linear in history and visual space coming out of Newton, and the new world of spaces is what the artists discover. And so in the Joycean framework, the cops are children of the sun, the people of space, and yet in McLuhan's system, the artists are what the cops are. And then the time guys are, in Joyce's world, the artists, but in McLuhan, they're the cops.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's automatically, there's a time issue, there's an issue of, historic period, because like when you're talking about the druidic and the control of memory is quite different from the visual containment and modalities of Newton. So automatically, because you've moved into a different historic period and using the same word for these two states, that it's already different.
Yeah, so he's right to change it. But I sometimes think that he changes it for satirical reasons. Like, he pointed out that cool did not mean what cool meant in the 1920s. And he explained why it meant something different. But he knew that people weren't aware of those subtleties and therefore would misinterpret and purposely be duped by his use of cool.
Yeah, I guess it's a deep awareness. If you push them all to their extreme, they do flip and they change their meaning. I mean, yeah. Mechanical Bride... you've got a wedding announcement found in concrete, where you've got like the space space-type cultures with its highways, motorways, and whatever, when pushed to extreme, it becomes a time-binding technology, something that we're going to have for 1,000 years, these massive memory systems that are our highways.
Yeah, and your point?
Well, the point being that right there you've got a flipping of terms.
Yeah. Okay, I got you. All right, so April 27th, 2011. Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow of the Iron Age. So...
Well, this could be good. I'm excited by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
All right, so... I don't know whether this title is a quote from McLuhan or not. Is this Andrew's statement?
Presumably.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Written in the front pages of the Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne, 1910, are the following words. There are a few... What is... There are a few I'm unsure of, so I'm including photographs of the two pages so you, dear reader, can see for yourself. In particular, I can't make out the first word, so any suggestions would be most welcome. Well, are we able to enlarge this?
Yeah, if you click on the image, it gives you a blow-up.
Ah, oh, good. Minds of the... I see the word minds at the very top. Something all minds of the... Order of Genius. Now, what does he have there? Does he... Oh, he has all minds. So what's the words that he's not getting?
It's the scribble before minds of. There's the, a little, like a quotation mark with a... it's almost, it's two words. It's who are. That's who it is. It's who are minds of the...
First order of genius. Yep. Who? Yep. Well, no, he's got all.
So it's in quotes. So I've got who are minds of the...
No, no, it's all minds. All minds, which is what he has. It's the word before all. It's a squibble before all. It looks like H-I, high, and a squibble to the left of it.
Yeah, okay, Kate.
Okay, so I don't think all minds, let's just start. Okay, so here's what, now this is something Marshall wrote on the inside of the Scarlet Letter, right?
Yep.
I think of the letter in Finnegan's Wake. So the letter, that's a major motif in Western literature. So, Marshall, this is going to prompt him to write something, right? I think he's going to have to write anything that uses the word letter, that's Marshall's. Those are fighting words for Marshall, right? Okay. All minds of the first order of genius, Hawthorne concerns himself with... Oh, so it's like all minds. Now, could you see...
Could be.
Like all minds. It's that meaning, as in all minds, right? You know, as in all minds. So he's saying Hawthorne is a first order of genius. Hawthorne concerns himself, all minds, as all minds of the first order, like all minds of the first order of genius. Hawthorne concerns himself with the great problems of the soul. Our generation had journeyed far from the Puritan era with its grim justice and its relentless penalties. But Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow of the Iron Age. That means way back there in the Puritan era, right?
Yep.
His intellect and imagination were alike fascinated by the Puritan idea of justice. Grim men and stern, those Puritans, having neither part nor lot in human infirmities, human weaknesses, and insensible alike to pleasure and to pain. This is like the extreme robotic nature of Western man before the electric telegraph starts to loosen them up. And is it Hawthorne who writes the Seven Gables?
Yes.
That's the one with the quote of the telegraph is a nervous membrane? It's Hawthorne who gets that credit?
Yep.
So that means, that means Hawthorne can see the new environment, but he's obsessed with those that are going to be useless in the new environment. They're too stiff. So you have these extreme mechanical robots, insensible alike to pleasure and to pain. Generations of these worthies slowly filtered through Hawthorne, and the precious drops fell into that vessel
names the Scarlet Letter, into that vessel named the Scarlet Letter. This study of conscience differs from the sentimental novels of today as the oak tree from the hyacinth. Hyacinth is not significant. What is hyacinth?
Oh, it's a plant.
Right. What's the... It's a light, fluffy... Maybe it's a token of sentiment kind of plant.
Yeah, well, it's... Wikipedia says... referred to as baby's breath. There's a genus of bulbing flowering plants. And this, yeah, bulbous and flowering. So it's, yeah.
It's sentimental stuff.
Yeah.
Hawthorne believed that the greatest thought that can occupy the human mind is the thought of justice and its retributive workings through conscience. Doubtless there are 1,000 questions that competes for the attentions of youth, but for men grown mature and strong, life offers no more momentous question than this. Here's the question. Can the soul, injured by temptation and seared by sin, ever recover its pristine vigor and strength and beauty? That's what McLuhan thought he had, pristine vigor and strength and beauty. Okay, so the issues of the soul are what these wooden men are concerned about, right? They're not concerned about justice. They're worried about, see, the soul is created by the alphabet. So they are very concerned about the individual psychology known as a soul. That is the obsession of visual space.
Well, you say, hold on a second, is the soul, I always find this as a sticking point in my understanding of McLuhan, is the soul created by the alphabet or is it made visible in and through the alphabet? As in made apprehendable and something that you can pay attention to.
If you look at the Gutenberg Galaxy, he deals with this on one page. He talks about the soul. He doesn't say it blatantly, but he talks, he has a bunch of quotes, and he points out that the soul is something created by visual space, not something to be seen.
Yeah, in his correspondence with Havelock, he's a little softer on that point.
Well, he's going to be careful. It's pretty blatant to tell someone there's a artifact of the visual of the alphabet. To try to tell that to your priest. I mean, it's mixed in with... and Thompson is pretty good. William Ernest Thompson's pretty good on the changes in the image of the soul through different eras, different media. You might want to look at that sometime. Don't have the book offhand, which one it is. But... I take Croker as talking about how Augustine resolves the question of the soul and creates the soul. And he doesn't see it as a product of media of the day, but I take it as Augustine is a figure for the product of the increasing visualization that's happening after the Roman Empire. So... I'm the one who makes the extreme case that the soul is a product of the alphabet.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so, like, so McLuhan, even in, like, I see the value in what you're saying, but I'm just sort of, like, in Havelock's preface to what we're looking at, The Future of Morality, The Inner Versus the Outer Quest, McLuhan makes a note that in the 5th century BCE, it became possible for a few Greeks to talk about having souls as if they... as though they had selves or personalities. So you get this. He's making that connection, but whether it actually made the soul per se, I guess that's another question altogether. I would if I put on the spot, I'd say McLuhan is saying that it makes possible to see, not necessarily doesn't make the soul per se.
Well, if there is a soul and it helps you see it, it is dressed differently because you're alphabetic.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, because he perceives the electric age as making empty, soulless people.
Or people that cannot recognize the soul.
Right. Even though there's more and more talk, and it's accepted in public more and more about the soul and matters of spirit in the New Age market, right? There's more talk about it in public, it seems, than in the earlier centuries.
Yeah, for sure.
People are obsessed about
their karma, and how they're doing in their reincarnation, how they're doing spiritually, spiritual correctness. I see that as proof of my point, and it's the New Age is trying to preserve the literate soul and are fetishizing over it.
Yeah, well, it's an okay. So another letter from McLuhan to William Jovanovich in February 2, 1972. He's makes a softer point where, well, he says he's saying fairly definitively that the private psyches originate with the phonetic alphabet and no other alphabet, but he doesn't go so far as to say it's the soul that is made by the phonetic alphabet.
But it is. It's hard to know what McLuhan means by soul.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, if you think it's, he's talking as a Catholic, it doesn't seem to fit into his media analysis. So I say it's, he's talking technically as a, the only way to make it acceptable in these kind of statements is to think of it as a product of the alphabet. Because it's nebulous if it's a religious definition. He's mixing apples and oranges. See, if he's saying that industrial man is obsessed with the soul, that's not true. There actually is the beginning of materialism in the conventional way. But if you think of the soul as a visual space artifact, then it makes sense and explains why the Puritan era was obsessed and why people aren't obsessed with that visual artifact now. Because it's a different ground. It's the emotional multitude that people think is their soul now. It's Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
It's the acoustic auditory imagination. That which reaches down and retrieves the earliest beginnings, brings back what is archaic, and the rest of the quote, you know? That reaches back to the beginnings and brings back to the end. You know that quote?
Yep.
By Eliot. That's what people are feeling when they listen to music now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, that's, we've experienced the soul in a myriad of ways.
Okay, so let's take it my way, because it doesn't fit the other way. I agree with you, my way can be questioned, you know what I mean?
But we're cool with that. I just had to, like, while we were being recorded, I would just suggest that that's that's a PhD thesis there, Bob. Somebody could go
over
and
do
that.
You could go over to Stratford and ask the Shakespeare where the soul came from. No, maybe you better go to Paris and talk to all the people who knew Proust's family. Go to one of the remembrance of things past. Can the soul injured by temptation, and well, we did that. Is it true that the breach can never really be mended, but only guarded, while always by the broken wall there lurks the stealthy tread of a foe that waits to renew his unforgotten trumpets? What the hell? Is McLuhan quoting something? There's no quote marks.
Oh, no, he's about to.
Yeah, so that's odd what he's saying here. It's like McLuhan becoming 19th century poetic.
Yeah, well, I guess he's, you know, he often says that he can write in, 10 different ways for everything he writes, at least in 10 different styles. So perhaps this is just an expression of that.
Yeah, he's becoming the medium of Hawthorne.
Yeah, well,
that era.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so then he has a quote. "I do not know, say the old Greek, that God has any right to forgive sins." Then Marshall, end of quote. Then Marshall says, "But Dante thinks sin may be consumed. And though Hawthorne dwelt in a grim, dark era, for him there was sunlight on the top of the mountains. He felt that somewhere life holds a fount, divine, where the dust." He felt that somewhere life holds a fountain divine, where the dust may be cleansed from the soul's wings. The remaining soul may recover its nature, simplicity, and dignity through repentance and confession. Ha! No, sorry. I thought he was laughing. Ha, ha, ha. Actually, it's Hawthorne. H-A-W. Hawthorne believed everything in the drama of the soul must be made to turn upon the open confession of sin. Therefore, among man possessions,
Therefore, among many possible transgressions, he selects the one sin that has the most reasons against acknowledgement and the one man in the community who would suffer the most by healing the hurts. And that his lesson might be the more convincing, he lends 1,000 extenuations to the wrongdoers. Extenuations. Thanks for reading, says Andrew. Well, is this Marshall's Catholicism?
Yeah, I mean, this is an enduring question. I mean, this is sin, forgiveness, repentance, confession.
Okay, so he's saying justice was an odd concern by Hawthorne in his day. To be concerned about justice was an anti-environment to what the Puritans were, the people around Hawthorne were concerned about. They were concerned about their soul and sin. And then Marshall goes into different aspects of how you can focus on one sin and forgive the 1,000 extenuations. So this is showing that the process of sin analysis in fragmented specialist man. Well, isn't that what Ben Franklin does? He would take one sin every day and work on it for a day or so.
Yes.
And then piece by piece, you know, improve himself. I think Marshall what he wrote here is him thinking out. And then he'll summarize all this when he goes public and say, well, the 19th century man regarded sin as a fragmentary specialist effort. Do you know what I mean? But we're seeing here Marshall work out the theological, poetic contents of what's going to be turned into a blurb in his next article.
No, I get it. He's dealing with these in the early 40s, where he's dealing about the Calvinists and the Puritans and how they flip into Rousseau and then how Rousseau flips into Marx, and so he's been with this these issues for what time is he when's he writing this?
When he went through what?
Well, it's hard to say when did he actually write this? It looks like this is quite early.
Yeah, these are the kind of things he wrote to his mother in the letters. These theological issues, right? He get very, very involved with conceptual stuff and the legacy of the dogma of being a Catholic or the issues a Catholic should be concerned about. Why doesn't he write any of this kind of stuff later? At least it's not known. So is he saying, this is what I'll write first, so it's included in my corpus, and I will not have to write this kind of stuff again? Not rejecting it, it's part of the one whole work of all his writings.
Yeah.
What's he saying about Ulysses? Joyce analyzes the individual psyche of Lupo Bloom, and then moves to the collective, the tribal mind, the collective soul, in Fitting His Wake. So Marshall moves from the very particular issues that a literate Christian would be concerned with to the broadest cartoons in the 70s, writing about populations being addicted to pattern recognition and why they're into Monty Python. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Very broad corporate imagery. Was he changed unwittingly? Was he changed and swept along and forgot all these issues that are indicated here in this note on Hawthorne?
No. I mean, it's his process is quite I think quite simple. I mean, I've got like a note here where he goes, he's talking about how Calvinists and Puritans insist on the utter depravity of man's nature, including his rational nature, and then he's talking about Rousseau. So he says Rousseau is a flip of them. Rousseau simply transferred man's depravity to his social institutions. And so in a certain sense, I guess McLuhan, his early McLuhan, his works are working on individual appetites, you know, and that self-debasement. And then he flips, and in a sense he follows that, and he starts looking at social institutions, media, whole grounds.
Well, Mark Stallman was outraged when I said that Marshall purposely kept his Catholicism secret, but it was part of his theater to draw attention to it when he found out about it,
and then find there's all these thoughts about the Catholic world, which you're seeing in his 40s writings. He talks about the nature of grace and all these issues. That's the private man. And then he becomes this guy writing broad cartoons in the 70s. He meant the two types to be noticed. So it was a strategy to keep the Catholicism hidden because that made it like it was separate. But he faked the separation, and actually it was an attacked opposition looking at the portrait of, you know, Montaigne. I owe the public a portrait. Marshall gave a portrait of his private, of the self that would have these private concerns over sin. And then he gave a portrait of the collectives in understanding media, the archetypes of the collective conscious.
Yep.
And he saw those two aspects are in Finnegan's Wake. Joyce is working out very personal issues, or putting it on, and then he has very broad issues. He could say it's the Lang versus the parole, you know, use structuralism.
Yep.
I think that Marshall, either he was very concerned and genuine what he wrote here, but then he got changed in the 50s. So he dropped all that stuff, but to create his shield of protection, his armor, he said, this will be my art form. I can have this sitting there as a testament to the private archetypes, and then develop the impersonal collective archetypes in the later books, and have it as a dialogue. The dilemma of being both. It could have been a larger script for a play, translating the drama, Finnegan's Wake. So I don't think anybody even know what I'm talking about. I think you understand what I'm talking about, but...
Yeah, no, I get it. Insofar as, like, I mean, I guess we've engaged with all this material, so it makes perfect sense. But I guess in a very simplistic approach, there is absolutely no audience in, you know, after World War II for this kind of conversation, apart from a very, very limited number of very partisan journals. You know, this is party line, in a sense.
That's right. It's the Renaissance stuff.
Yeah.
But he's writing about it in ways that people can't even get into.
Yeah, it's great. He would have been an incredible scholar had he just stayed in this sort of mode.
Yeah, but it's... who would want too much opportunities to enjoy oneself after World War II?
Yeah.
Why be a monk?
So I'd like to reread this after we've said all this. Reread what he said with the perspective. You know, you and I are one of the only people who know he wrote this stuff. I mean, I assume O'Grady read it. I don't know if he thinks about it. But I've always thought about those essays that he wrote in the 40s, these kind of issues.
Yeah.
This is a great selection. I mean, this is a very valuable excerpt Andrew has brought forth. I mean, to take the time to write it all out, it's pretty good. It'd be nice if there's more of this, that he presents more. Right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's why we're here, yeah?
Yeah, so in light of all that we said, the different levels to approach this, let's redo it. I'm going to read it through. Like all minds of the first order of genius, which Marshall would consider himself part of, right?
It's that's old, I remember where that comes from. That's like old Cambridge talk. That's a real, where is it? Matthew Arnold, isn't it? It's like the, you know, first order genius and second order genius.
Yeah, okay. All minds of the first order of genius, like all minds of the first order of genius, Hawthorne concerns himself with the great problems of the soul. Our generation had journeyed far from the Puritan era with its grim justice and its relentless penalties. But Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow of the Iron Age. His intellect and imagination were alike fascinated by the Puritan idea of justice. Grim men and stern, those Puritans. Grim men and stern, those Puritans, having neither part nor lot in human infirmities or weaknesses, and insensible alike to pleasure and to pain. Generations of these worthies slowly filtered through Hawthorne, and the precious drops fell into that vessel named the Scarlet Letter. This study of conscience differs from the sentimental novels of today as the oak tree from the hyacinth.
Hawthorne believes that the greatest thought that can occupy the human mind is the thought of justice and its retributive working through conscience. Doubtless there are a thousand questions that compete for the attentions of youth. But now there's an interesting point. A thousand questions, information overload.
Yep.
I think he's talking about today, or his 40s. Doubtless there are a thousand questions that compete for the attention of youth. But for men grown mature and strong, life offers no more momentous question than this. Can the soul injured by temptation and seared by sin ever recover its pristine vigor and strength and beauty? Is it true that the breach can never really be mended, but only guarded? While always, by the broken wall, there lurks the stealthy tread of a foe that waits to renew his unforgotten trumpets. So he's saying there's someone there who will remind you of your mistakes.
Yep.
Of your failings. Is it true that the breach can never really be mended, but only guarded, while always by the broken wall there lurks the stealthy tread of a foe that waits to renew his unforgotten trumpets?
So then there's this quote.
He quotes, maybe it's a quote from the book or something. I do not know, says the old Greek, that God has any right to forgive sins. But Dante, says McLuhan, thinks sin may be consumed, and though Hawthorne dwelt in a grim, dark era, for him there was sunlight on top of the mountains. He felt that somewhere life holds a fountain divine where the dust may be cleansed from the soul's wings. So Hawthorne felt that you could renew yourself. That's what he's saying, right?
No, that's Dante. So it's contrasting the... The Catholicism of Dante against...
No. He says, Dante thinks sin may be consumed. And though Hawthorne dwelt in the grim dark air for him... Oh, in the grim dark air for him. Who's the him? Dante? And though Hawthorne dwelt... See, no. He's talking about Hawthorne. Even though he dwelt in a dark era, like Dante...
Okay.
Yeah, like Donnie, for him there was sunlight in the top of the mountains. He felt that somewhere life holds a fountain divine where the dust may be cleansed from the soul's wings. The remaining soul may recover its natural simplicity and dignity through repentance and confession. So Marshall, I think this is autobiographical, Marshall's always finding in his heroes a positive outcome. Like, you know, Joyce had a great celebration of delectable
yeah, Hawthorne, you know, he is a Puritan, but secretly he's a Catholic because
he sees the sun.
Yeah.
What else? I know one night in a seminar, it was interesting. It was the first. It was odd. We were talking. Everybody was talking, and McLuhan. Someone said something, and McLuhan says, "Yes, but a man can change," and he said it so. Esalen Institute type. I don't think he... I heard it that way because you heard many of the New Agers and the human potential movement psychologists would talk about that kind of change. I think it was a profounder thing in McLuhan and not the echoes of social fad about changing oneself.
Yep.
But he stood up. He actually thought that a person could change, that you could accomplish something. And I'm thinking, this is what he's writing about. He's projecting what he felt into Hawthorne.
Yeah, and I guess in a certain sense, it's talking about the metaphysics of change in terms of the, as you raised Franklin, and I think, doesn't McLuhan say that the Franklin approach is the precursor to Dale Carnegie's... strategies for successful people, and this is the work on the soul, and as opposed to the Pauline tradition, which is never to work on the soul directly, but to work outside oneself, to go out, and presumably to be changed from the outside in through a divine act.
Through creating a city of God, through creating a new human community.
Yeah, or the sacrament of reconciliation, in the case maybe in here.
Okay, so... If we're not able to use theological terms, that's not relevant here. The more general patterns are important. You don't need to know Catholic particulars, because McLuhan is critiquing the Ben Franklin way of fragmenting the perfections and purifying one by one.
Yep.
You know, so what is the way one gets rid of the sin... If you don't do it the visual Gutenberg way,
right? You know, how would one do it? By studying the effects of media?
What for McLuhan?
Yeah, like if he's not going to pick apart his frailties of a soul, the infirmities of a soul, one by one, and one by one, you know, cure them, like Franklin, if that's a product of visual space, and McLuhan's not limited to visual space, what is the format, what's the way the soul resolves itself in electric age, if you're an electric man? That's why I begin to think all this soul stuff is literate stuff, and he's registering the final questions for literate man, but they don't concern Marshall.
Well, yeah, I mean, isn't that what the mum session where in the later hours Dave Worcester's talking about how he modulates his media environment as opposed
to...
So that would be the contemporary strategic equivalent of picking things apart and going, working directly on the soul that way.
Yeah, your soul has been externalized into the central, into the TV environment.
Yeah, so the new Puritans have flipped into the absolute wild opposite of what they perceive themselves to be.
Yeah, and so you get that? The extension of the central nervous system might be a cover for the soul.
Yeah, that would be interesting to explore. I'll think about
that. Yeah, the television extends the soul. It's no longer the internal light, the inner light. It becomes the external light. Well, that's a journey we've made, and we've moved McLuhan into whole new realms that no one else will appreciate.
Well, we can send 10 PhDs in that, Bob. We'll assign the task tomorrow.
To who?
Assign the tasks tomorrow. We'll put them out as a list of PhD topics.
Yeah, no. Like we'll assign different enemy sessions. Okay, you study what Bob and Andrew create in session number one. Someone else does session two. There should be PhDs about each of these sessions because we're saying things that have never been said about McLuhan.
Yep.
Most people thought he wasn't worth thinking about.
Yeah, or that he's easy, or that he was... Same themes. He's just repeating the same themes, Bob. It's just the same stuff again and again. He didn't change, Bob.
Yeah, it's like I was marveling in Mom about how smart the 22-year-old McLuhan is. Here I'm marveling how smart the 40-year-old McLuhan is. You know, he's writing these in-depth things, issues, right?
Yeah.
And he is talking about different media eras. He's talking about the Iron Age. It's a different environment. This could be before Innes.
Yeah, I've got it pegged at early 50s, late 40s.
It's like he does it in his Manitoba essays or articles. He crudely refers to the external mediated environment as affecting people. He's intuiting the medium as a message very early, and he uses it in his criticism. Okay, here's Hawthorne struggling under the pre-telegraph world. You know, he's naming the ground that Hawthorne's working from.
Yep.
McLuhan always was aware, that's what we can say, he's always aware of the ground, of some technical ground or larger environment that people are inside of, being molded by. And his, all his work is a refinement of that environment, an expansion of the meanings of the word environment to finally get a tetrad out of it. Okay, so we're at this point where it makes, actually rereading this makes sense. He is, he felt that somewhere life holds a fountain divine where the dust may be cleansed from the soul's wings. The remaining soul may recover its natural simplicity and dignity through repentance and confession. Hawthorne believed everything in the drama of cognition, must be made to turn upon the open confession of sin. Now remember, McLuhan defined sin in the 70s as not willing to investigate what invades your privacy. Do you remember that part? He says, the natural reluctance to look at what's affecting you in your environment, to do mediacology, is sin. Did you notice he updates that?
This is a bit of a stuff that I don't know. I really should have gone and looked at this in depth, and I think I should. No, I don't remember that.
I'm talking about stuff he wrote in the 70s. You're saying that part you missed. Is that what you're saying? I guess in the 40s.
Yeah.
70s stuff. See, here's the thing. He's puzzled why nobody wants to study media like he does. And he comments on Western Man, doesn't want to know the consequences of his environments. And then I think he generalizes it into people, human beings, do not want to know the consequences of what they do. That's a more comprehensive idea of taking responsibility for your freedom, right? You can be free, but you must be responsible. He makes it part of your environment, almost like an Eskimo. Hey, you want to be moral around here, and then you study the effects of the oven on the whaling industry, or us seals we got to beat up to eat. And he says that is the original sin. So that's a different. The confession of sin would be to confess that you're not interested in knowing the effects of things.
I've also got another piece in here where he's. I guess this is where we. I guess he indirectly talks about sin then in those terms in relation to how people approach poetry and art.
What did I miss that? Are you quoting something? Are you going to read something?
No, it's just exploring an idea here that I'm sort of...
Say it again.
It's just in seed form. McLuhan often appears to almost to talk about sin in those terms then, under the alibi or guise of how people approach poetry and art and how they read.
Right. Technique versus sensibility.
Yeah. So, for example... So what does it mean where he says he's critiquing a kind of approach to reading a poem? The question, what does it mean? Itself, it means a kind of reader not prepared to look at the poem. He wants a conceptual formula instead of an experience, so he's not going to look at it directly. He will not make the act of faith, Coleridge said, was the first condition of contact with art. He distrusts anything that he must submit. He cannot relax his dialectical muscles and receive. And then he'll go on and talk about Eliot's The Hollow Men. The dilemma of the hollow men who fear the dilemma of the hollow men who fear direct eyes and who blind themselves willingly and in whim the object of desire are not. I've written this really badly.
What are you reading from?
The Hollow Man.
It's an essay?
Yeah,
an
essay by McLuhan on Eliot. So the dilemma of the hollow men who fear direct eyes and who blind themselves willingly, and I think it's have a particular relationship to the object of desire, not the radiance of created or revealed beauty, but only the self-engendered images of their own idolatry, a condition of living and death. So here, I mean, in Mum we talked about the marriage of art and theology, Paul and Apollo. And so in this sense, McLuhan's taking up this way of art criticism as a way of talking about sin, perhaps.
Yeah, and now I got a big insight. McLuhan knows that these speculations, he's talking about the literate idea of sin. There, when you are wearing the whole world as your sleeve in the electric age, then your sin is the environment that has to be analyzed. And if you don't analyze it or study the effects of it, you're sinning. You have to update your realm of investigation. You have to update what you are denying. You have to if you go around worrying about...
I've got it in simple terms. Like... before reconciliation, which was formerly confession, Bob, you've got to undertake an inspection of your conscience. And so
you're quite, wasn't that said here? You're quoting...
No, I'm not quoting. I'm just talking about
experience. No, but he says something about that. So retributive workings through conscience.
Yeah, and so like if you've got the externalization of the entire central nervous system, what does an inspection of conscience actually entail?
That's right. And Marshall realized there were newer sins being created.
Well, that's never been said before, but it follows naturally.
Yeah, and I think it's great that you remember that Worcester talked about, like a yogi, modulating his interaction with TV and his movement. Well, how did you say it? He was doing a kind of self-yoga.
Yeah.
And how he entertained himself.
Oh, he cast it specifically in terms of protecting himself from the shit that's on.
Yeah, and that's what Marshall, I brought that up, quoting from that article in the 54 where he criticizes the Catholic for not noticing the signs and seduction around them in the information environment. They're not even aware of what they should be confessing about. I failed to notice the hidden ground this week. Go to the priest. I failed to notice the effects of the railroad and the new CN Tower they built. It had profound effects on my kids, and I forgot to tell them what effects are going to happen when they get the new transistor radio. You know, this is the...
So when you look at... This 40 stuff is him talking in the literate, old-fashioned concerns... But he's groping to realizing that there's newer sins. That's why he drops the literary language.
Yeah, I've just got a new insight as well. Like, there's that interesting letter to Roger Cavalieri in November 1973 where McLuhan says, the Jesuits, as the first order founded under Gutenberg auspices, now interface with an antithetic age, which is obviously crying out for a new religious order to embody these problems of electronic or discarnate man. So that's maybe what the he would see as one of the functions of that new order, to provide a new program for the inspection of conscience.
Yeah, and you know the famous line from Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Lot. As a young artist. Portrait of the Artist as a Young... What is
man?
It?
Portrait
young
of
man.
The Artist as a Young
yeah.
Man.
He says, I go forth for the millionth time to forge the uncreated conscience of my race. You have to keep going forward because things, new sins are being created. Not the sins of chemical body immorality. See, you have to know... Here's McLuhan saying, you can't have morals in the electric age. But
no,
it doesn't
natural,
mean there are
natural,
not new sins. What?
Yeah, if natural law has been eclipsed.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean there's a new kind of sin. So he actually is creating a new religious order. He should be considered a saint by the Catholic Church. They're just dimly perceiving that he is probing. Here's a guy who didn't have one proper definition of the theological scholars around him at St. Mike's, actually dealing with the real new theology. They didn't even care about their words. Formal causality, well... Everybody is sort of acting efficient. That's probably the cause. They're all motivated under kinetic and visual space conditions. They're missing the forms of things. So what's that word, formal causality? Okay, yeah, formal causality, the cause of forms. He put new meaning in that phrase. It had nothing to do with the meaning that Aristotle meant. It's just the word was the appropriate word, the causality of forms. He says in Playboy, I study the life of forms. That's formal causality. It's a pun.
Yeah.
and it's just quick terms to point out what should be obvious to people, that they're in a new, they're wearing new clothing and new sins are being covered up. See, that's why he would be slack and not, he'd be what Croker called a liberal. He didn't have the neoconservative or the fundamentalist concerns about sin. He says these fundamentalists don't even know what sin is, the new sin. The new sin is you can be your own prince of the air. You can create hardware and software environments. You can be an engineer.
Yep.
So, yeah, when he defines the Antichrist as a superior, what does he say, the great engineer? Well, maybe 99% of humanity's engineers are alive today. I'm playing off the 99% of human scientists.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar.
And we actually made a new breakthrough here. He actually was the new pope. He was defining the new issues. The people didn't even know they were sinning.
Yeah, so he wrote the You Done It. So I guess then the Manipian satire becomes the most appropriate and if not only way of... providing a forum for these
new thoughts,
issues,
yeah.
ideas.
Yeah. yeah. No, that's a good point. Art and theology. Theology, which is about sin and art, art was the environment. And you had to do art criticism, that's where you did your confession about the sins you were aware of, through your perception of what the art environment was. Not paintings and sculpture, but the new media environments were the art forms. But we actually made a breakthrough here, Andrew. This is way beyond what anybody's ever thought of.
Well, maybe somebody will even listen to it one day, Bob.
Beg your pardon?
Maybe somebody might even listen to it one day.
Yeah, in about 100 years, they'll listen to it, and then that'll spark what Morris McClune predicted. We won't understand McClune for 100 years, and that's when they hear our stuff. Then they'll say, oh, that's what he was about. Yeah, makes sense. We're 100 years ahead of our time. It's like, did you look at that Walter Bowert, me and Walter Bowert dialogue from 1990 on that pixel that Jerry made? Did you watch that?
I did.
You did?
Yeah, it was a brief, though. I, like, flashed through it.
Oh, man, you got to watch it, because Bowert says to me, you know, Bob, there are only two people in the world who can understand you. And there's a pause, and he says, and you haven't met them yet. He understood that. He understood that I was addressing, like, McLuhan 1,000 years ahead of our time.
That replaying is, that's the B-Fart, updating the B-Fart comment, isn't it?
The B-Fart quote?
Yeah, yeah.
What, there are only 40 people in the world?
Yeah, yeah, and one of them's a ham.
Five parts of rhetoric. The five levels of exegesis. The pentad is five of them are dead. No, five of them are hamburgers. So, where are we? We finished the section?
Yeah, we finished the section. I think we should probably look to bring it to a close for the evening. We've been going on for, I think, just over 2 hours.
And so I want to read the comments. So WCM, I don't know who that says, I believe the first word in the Hawthorne passage is like. I appreciate the good work you are doing. So we agreed on that, right?
Yep.
Like all of my, okay. And then there's old James J. Lewis again. Excellent, important work. Terrific photography as usual. Okay. And then now here is WCM's some different readings of the Hawthorne piece. Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow. Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow, names the scarlet letter. Oh, this is different translations of the words. Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow should be Hawthorne dwells beneath the shadow. Names the scarlet letter. I noticed that it should be named the scarlet letter. So he's correcting Andrew's translation. His unforgotten trumpet should be his unforgotten triumphs. I do not know, say the old Greek, should be, says the old Greek. Remaining soul should be sinning soul. Healing their hurts. Telling the truth. Now the hurt, look at the hurts that new media cause. Telling the truth is healing the hurts. Then he writes, it would be highly interesting to know if there are any indications of the date of these remarks. Does the handwriting belong to an identifiable period, perhaps around 1930? This is someone who's, like you, Andrew, got to know the time, got to know whether it's early McLuhan or later McLuhan.
Yeah, it is important.
Yeah, so Andrew thinks it's early to mid-30s, I think, for date. This is what Barry Nevis said, the guy who was into moral rearmament in the 30s.
Yep.
These are right when he's becoming a Catholic or right before or after. He's very involved in the conceptual meanings of Catholicism. But by the late 40s, you realize how stupid his Catholicism is, and he gets into the new issues of being a new kind of Catholic. And this, Mr. Stallman, is what you need to attend to.
Excellent.
Yeah, we are finished. It is finished.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Bob. I'll push the stop now.